This is a Rabble Podcast Network show.
New voices in your head.
It's radio.
Free
radio.
You're listening to Feminist Current, making waves in the mainstream.
Let me clear space for you to sit beside me. You don't need your back against the wall.
You are listening to Feminist Current. I'm Megan Murphy. Today on the show, I speak to Rahila Gupta, a freelance journalist and writer whose work has been published at Open Democracy, The Guardian, and New Humanist. Rahila has published several books, including From Homebreakers to Jailbreakers, South All Black Sisters, Provoked, and her most recent book, Enslaved, The New British Slavery. I spoke with her over the phone from her home in London. Just an apology, there is a little bit of static early in the interview, which passes.
I first discovered your work when I read your article, Has Neoliberalism Knocked Feminism Sideways? And I think that's something we talk about a lot, you know, especially on the left, as well as feminism. But neoliberalism is a term we use a lot these days, just because it's had such a devastating impact, I think, on ideology and politics and the economy and people's lives. I wonder if you can first explain what that means, just in case people don't know.
Well, I would see neoliberalism, I mean, it's the latest phase, if you like, of capitalism. And basically, it entails deregulation and privatization of state services. And it's almost because neoliberalism has kind of failed to deliver growth, I mean, especially in the West, and therefore profits. And so at one level, it's a kind of scraping of the barrel, because where else do you have left to go except taking over state services? And because we've got, for example, in Britain, a Tory government who believes in the deregulation and the rolling back of the state. I mean, so did Labour, so did New Labour. So it's not primarily a Tory phenomenon. So yeah, basically, it was a response to the last recession in the 70s. And what we've seen, and this is happening across the world, is that state being rolled back and the kind of services that were provided by the state, especially when it comes to things like welfare, have been privatized. And so I suppose that is the essence of neoliberalism.
So I wonder then if you can talk about how neoliberalism has impacted feminist discourse and the feminist movement from your perspective.
First of all, I think the issue was that there was a critique of the state that feminists had, which was that the state was paternalistic and it was patriarchal, because a lot of the kind of benefits and the legislation that state had passed, say, in the 60s and the 70s, was very much constructed around the idea of men as the male, the breadwinner, and constructed the family in such a way that women had a secondary role, and therefore they had a secondary role in the public sphere, and as far as opportunity, equality of opportunity in terms of getting jobs or education, all of it had an impact on all of that. So there was a very valid feminist critique of the state as being paternalistic and patriarchal. Now, because neoliberalism depends on the reduced role of the state, it shared that particular critique. It suited neoliberalism to reaffirm the feminist critique of the state as an excuse then to roll it back. Now, that convergence of feminist critique with neoliberalism has led some commentators, and I think I mentioned that in my article, women like Nancy Fraser, to say, well, actually, to go that step further and say that the presence of feminism and feminist discourse and ideology actually legitimated and accommodated neoliberalism. I disagree with that. I think that the two things happen to coincide, but actually the critique that feminism makes of the patriarchal state was not in the interests of neoliberalism. So they have nothing to say. The right has nothing to say about patriarchy. And in fact, it encourages certain patriarchal ways of being because it helps to sell goods.
Mm-hmm. You tie that, and you know, I see those connections as well for sure. You tie that to a recent emphasis in feminism on things like agency and free choice and in your words, self-sufficiency of the individual. And, you know, what do you think is problematic about that in terms of women's liberation and the women's movement?
I mean, you know, it started off as a positive thing because women were never allowed to exercise agency, to have free choice. Their interests were always subsumed or subjugated, you know, were to the interests of the family, to the interests of men, and so on and so forth. So it has a good starting point, but basically what I feel that we are seeing now is that choice has become such a buzzword that there is no critical analysis of what's going on with regard to choice. And I believe that feminism is a collective project, and that if we make choices that disadvantage other women, then that is an undermining of the project of feminism, if you like. And especially, I mean, for example, you take something like cosmetic surgery, you know, women will sort of trumpet that as exercising free choice. They have the money now, perhaps, you know, they feel empowered, they feel they can go out, and they justify it as they are making a choice for themselves, to make themselves feel good. But actually, what they're doing is that they are continuing to implicitly suggest that women are both meat and commodity, which is, you know, essentially how patriarchy constructs women. So by exercising what they think is free choice, when it disadvantages other women and it undermines the struggle, then I think there's a problem there.
Yeah. And actually, you call the feminism produced through neoliberalism fake feminism. So I wonder if you can explain why you say that.
Well, it's sort of connected with what I've just said around the issue of choice. I feel that it's sort of nothing more. This fake feminism is nothing more than the supposed freedom of women to exercise agency, the kind of agency that patriarchy had traditionally disallowed them. So superficially, it seems liberating. But as I say, because the choices they make don't actually challenge sexism or patriarchy, then, you know, it's a kind of a fake feminism.
Right. You know, something I've been thinking about a lot, and I wondered if you had any thoughts on it, was this fetishization of the feminine. And I wonder if you've noticed that or if you see that happening at all. And if you do see that, where do you see it coming from?
I mean, I think this is going on in parallel to the critique of it, the feminist critique. I think there is a really big resurgence at the moment amongst the younger feminists who are critiquing this whole idea of the feminine, the fetishization of the feminine. Again, I feel that there is this issue of the feminine being reappropriated from a position of power, is how those who are fetishizing it see it. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah.
It's part of that same phenomenon, I feel, that I've sort of defined as fake feminism, that we are now, we have gone past the stage. Yes, our attention has been drawn to the fact that the feminine was actually, you know, in the old days, a sign of our oppression. But we have gone past that into a new phase where we know we are aware of it, but now we are adopting it because we like it for ourselves. So there's a little bit of that going on, kind of a reappropriation as if from a position of new power, but it's really not. It's really the same old.
Yeah, and I guess you could tie it to the idea of post-feminism, where people might think that because we're aware of the sexism, we're allowed to go back and and play with that idea mm-hmm. and fetishize the feminine. And as you say, it's about, you know, personal empowerment and personal choice, and therefore it's perceived or represented as being okay because it's about individuals making choices.
That's right. Yeah. And it's within a depoliticized context.
Mm-hmm.
That's the problem.
Yeah. You've been critical of the way in which identity politics have maybe weakened the feminist movement and feminist discourse. I wonder if you can talk about that and maybe some examples of that.
Well, I mean, again, I would say that it started off as a necessary corrective because, you know, the women's lib movement of the 70s had certain homogenizing tendencies, you know, where the agenda did not include demands for tackling specific discrimination faced by, say, black women or lesbians or working class women or so on and so forth. So it started off as a very important corrective, but it ended up becoming a cul-de-sac, and it sort of weakened the possibility of political solidarity. So at its worst, what you get is it kind of prevents a political critique of a position by anyone who doesn't share that identity. So I feel that sharing an identity does not necessarily mean sharing the same political values. And I feel that it imposes a false unity on members of a group based on identity. So I feel it's very inadequate from that point of view. And, you know, it's an issue, for example, as a non-Muslim woman, but as an Asian woman, if I want to be critical of women who adopt the hijab, I am not allowed to speak on that issue. Identity politics sort of silences us. I wrote a piece on trans politics and feminisms, and, you know, there were like 200 or something comments on it, most of them quite shrill. But it becomes like you don't have the right to be critical of the values that their choices imply. So, you know, so I've critiqued the wearing of the hijab, saying why it represents a backward step for women because it makes us carry the burden of men's lust, you know, which has been the issue that we've been fighting against. You know, we used to have judges sitting in rape cases saying, well, you were in the wrong place at the wrong time. Why were you dressed in a particular way? And we've had to argue that and say we are not to blame. By wearing the hijab, Muslim women are setting back the feminist cause. Now, I feel I don't argue for a ban. I feel I should debate this issue. I should say what it means for feminist values. And, of course, at the end of the day, if a Muslim woman chooses to prioritize her race identity over her gender identity, that is her choice in a sense. You know, that's but it should be open to debate and negotiation. But it ends up with a lot of anger and, you know, heat, and often becomes a sort of a screaming match. And that's where I think we're going wrong.
Yeah. And, you know, you mentioned a couple of those pretty key issues in feminism that are also very heated and very divisive. The debate around the hijab, the debate around transgenderism, and then, of course, there's also the debate around the sex industry that's extremely mm-hmm. divisive in feminism right now. And, you know, a lot of those debates are rooted in those ideas of choice and identity. And, as it seems you've noticed, you know, those issues are also used in a way that seems to want to silence conversation and silence debate as opposed to encourage it. You know, I see women being no-platformed for their positions on prostitution or even, you know, arguments they've made around transgenderism and labeled as bigots around arguments that, you know, aren't bigoted, but just are arguments that maybe aren't popular or that certain groups don't agree with. And I wonder what you think about, you know, why are these debates so divisive? Why are they being used as an excuse to shut down discourse and blackball women within, you know, the feminist movement? It seems out of place, and it seems misguided to silence women within feminism or in the name of feminism.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's partly to do, although I couldn't put that argument for the sex industry, I was going to say it's partly to do with the defensiveness of a newly found sort of voice, you know, and I think that the trans, particularly trans women, are shrill in their defense of their position because it's a newly empowered community. And I think, you know, I remember back to the 80s when black women had just found their voices and I think did some appalling things. You know, I remember, for example, going to the very first feminist book fair where there were a number of events that were organized, and one of them was where the Egyptian writer Nawal el-Saadawi was speaking, and it was full because most women had pre-booked, realizing that, you know, she's very popular, and a contingent, and I was standing by the door waiting to go in, and a contingent of black women turned up and found it was full up and made, you know, and this is also ties in with identity politics, created a huge ruckus saying, you know, this is one of our own and we are not being allowed to go in. I mean, you know, the simple truth of it was that the others had pre-booked, you know, but it became a black-white thing. And eventually, I think some white women were thrown out in order to make room for these black women, which I just thought was appalling behavior. So, you know, it starts off with a very sort of important corrective in terms of the racism of white women's movement, but then it becomes really shrill. And so at one level, what I'm trying to say is that it's possibly a phase. And that, you know, once it settles down, there will be greater maturity, and therefore people will be prepared to listen to the arguments both for and against and come to, you know, a more settled position, if you like. This is my optimistic analysis of it. Mm-hmm. Because I think it's a huge challenge to the whole notion of what is gender, you know, and what is the sex of, I mean, okay, so we've kind of had long discussions around gender and, you know, is it a social construction or not and so on. But then to actually question the very notion of the sex of a person, the biological sex, what is and what isn't, and how does that tie in with gender, is like, you know, it's kind of shaking the ground from under us. So it will take time before we can come up with an analysis and a narrative which means that we will come perhaps to a new feminist understanding of who and what we are. But, you know, I have my criticisms of the trans community, but it doesn't sit well. It becomes, you know, it feels like an attack on them. And of course, I feel that it's really important, you know, and I completely support, you know, their right to equality and human rights and so on and so forth. But what they stand for, or what some of them stand for, just like the hijab, for me, it's a very comparable issue to the hijab. If I have an issue with what the hijab represents, I have an issue with what the kind of heightened femininity that certain trans women adopt represents for feminism as a whole. Yeah, so I think partly it's to do with defensiveness of a newish movement. I think the sex industry, you know, it kind of goes to the heart. I mean, at one level, I'm always surprised by why that particular issue should arouse such heated debate, because it's so tied in with the way women are perceived, the way they are commodified, the way they are objectified. You know, so many feminists will campaign around representation and so on and so forth in the media, that it's not a great leap to then say, well, the sex industry only extends that commodification, you know, and so therefore I find it very difficult to understand the position of those who wanted to continue. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean I would be an abolitionist, but I feel that there is another position in between, which is that there are women who work in the sex industry. They are driven to it by poverty, drug dependency, whatever. They do need to have their conditions improved, safeguarded, protected, whilst we work towards an ending of the industry. So I kind of have a little bit more of a in-between position on it. But, you know, I sort of see, I almost see it as a no-brainer, and I can only feel that that those who argue for it are the small percentage of articulate women who do very well out of it, but actually they do very well out of it at the expense of perpetuating certain ways of looking at women. And so for me, that is a problem. But those women probably don't face the violence that I think is implicit in the whole industry. And they and the pimps, you know, who stand most to profit, have a voice. And I genuinely believe, although we never get proper statistics in this field, I genuinely believe that the vast majority of women in the sex industry are thoroughly and totally disempowered and, you know, and just brutalized, you know. And so we really do need to work. Anyway, I've given you my position on the sex industry rather than... But I just don't understand the divisiveness on that particular issue. I sort of understand it on the other things, but not on that.
Mm-hmm. My last question is, you know, I guess I wonder, what are the primary issues you'd like to see addressed by the feminist movement? What do you think is missing? What do you think needs to happen? Were there to be something called a fourth wave? You know, wave theory isn't always the most useful way to describe the feminist movement, but it is one way of looking at it. So I wonder, you know, what would you like to see from a fourth wave if there were to be one?
Well, I think that a very big threat to our freedoms is posed by religion and religious fundamentalism. And I feel that that issue is taken on more by black women. I mean, it's partly to do with the fact that perhaps, I mean, well, in America, the situation is different because you do have the evangelical Christian lot who are, you know, homophobic and anti-abortion and so on and so forth and really dangerous. But perhaps the church in England is a little bit more liberal on those issues, and therefore perhaps English women or British women certainly don't see that as a threat. But if you look at it as a worldwide issue, you know, in Africa, in Latin America, in on the subcontinent, in the Asian subcontinent, you know, even in Russia, you know, Putin is in sort of bed with the Russian Orthodox Church. You know, across the world, religion is rearing its head, and it is a real danger for women. And I think that that's an issue that has really sort of bypassed the feminist movement and needs to be taken more seriously.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
No, you're very welcome.
Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye.
You just heard an interview with writer and journalist Rahila Gupta. You can find more of her work at Open Democracy, The Guardian, and New Humanist. Her most recent book, Enslaved, The New British Slavery, explores the role of immigration controls in enslaving people with no formal status. That is all the time we have for today. I'm Megan Murphy. Thanks for tuning in to Feminist Current. Feminist Current is a syndicated show produced by Megan Murphy out of Vancouver, BC, Canada. For more information on the show, please visit www.feministcurrent.com. If your station would like to air Feminist Current, you can find episodes at audioport.org or email us at info@feministcurrent.com.